Hello from Patricia Glynn and Storycatcher. My dogs and I aren't on the road right now because I'm busy downscaling from my very wonderful but very large Iveco truck to something smaller, which will arrive in our lives early next year, I hope. So the stories we're featuring every fortnight are those that are within easy reach of the Magaliesberg where I live. We've called them sabbatical stories. Just before we start today's interview, a note. Long-time listeners to Storycatcher will know that I live in a safari camp and record my links in a tent. There are times when we're on deadline, there's a storm brewing and the tent frame is creaking and the canvas is billowing, and it sounds as if we're in an old ship under sail. This is one of those times. But as it happens, it's entirely appropriate here because the chat in this edition includes talk of Elizabethan adventurers sailing to the New World. I hope you enjoy it. You know, for my money, the elixir of youth is to be found in curiosity. Curiosity makes us interested and interesting. It keeps us engaged in life and in others. It keeps our brains ticking and our hearts reaching. You're about to meet someone who has oodles of curiosity. I hope you'll forgive me for saying he is something of a curiosity too. He's a dinkum polymath, he's an eccentric, and he has one of the finest minds ever to emerge from South Africa. He's one of the kindest people you'll meet, and he's an internationally renowned paleoanthropologist and evolutionary scientist. But he has some rather quaint other interests, one of which we'll bring you today. He is Professor Francis Thackeray, and I've known him for years, which is why you'll hear me taking liberties in our chat. And our chat is about whether or not William Shakespeare smoked dacha. Our story develops as a series of eureka revelations. We start with the first, which takes place on a quiet evening in suburban Pretoria.
One Christmas evening, the family had gone to bed, and I went off to my study, to my thinking chair, and I decided I was going to read all of the sonnets from 1 to 154.
As one does on a Christmas night.
And it was such a pleasure. I started at 1, and it made no sense. I continued to 2, and it didn't make sense. But by the time I got to sonnet 76, that was when I had a eureka moment.
Because
there were two lines in particular. One line read, compounds strange. And that was fascinating because compounds was a word which could mean drugs. It could also refer to literary compounds, words combined to form one, literary compounds. But Shakespeare had written compounds strange, which could potentially mean strange drugs. And two lines later, he uses the words invention in a noted weed. Invention in a noted weed could mean creative writing in the sense of invention, but weed, well, one wondered. Weed was actually a term that could mean tobacco, and there were various kinds of tobacco. But it just occurred to me that when he'd linked creative writing to the weed, that was the second eureka moment, and I thought, how are we going to test this idea ever that Shakespeare might have been smoking dacha? And as it so happened, I have in front of me a book. It was published only in 1922, called Shakespeare's Garden. In that year, it was decided that they were going to dig up the foundations of Shakespeare's house to prepare a garden where they planted flowers of the kind that Shakespeare had referred to in plays. And when they were digging up this foundation to prepare a new garden, they discovered pipes, broken pipes, clay pipes that came with long stems that were used for smoking tobacco.
During the reign of Queen Elizabeth I in the 16th century, daring explorers like Sir Francis Drake and Sir Walter Raleigh set sail from Plymouth, England, in astonishingly tiny galleons and disappeared over the horizon in search of new lands, new knowledge, and of course gold, silver, and glory. They visited the Americas and famously brought back to the court of Queen Elizabeth such exotic finds as potatoes, corn, and most famously of all, tobacco. Even the Queen was reported to have had a puff. Did they also bring back cannabis from the New World? Probably not. Cannabis sativa had been cultivated in Europe for centuries because its tough fibres were used for the finest ropes, essential in an age where intrepid seafarers relied on wind-driven sailing ships. But there was a type of cannabis grown in India which was definitely intoxicating, and it is likely that it was imported into England by the British East India Company. The company was founded in 1600, and Shakespeare only died in 1616, so the dates fit nicely. But was the bard smoking doob? One Francis Thackeray set about finding the answer.
It was just remarkable to find in this book, Shakespeare's Garden, a photograph, a fuzzy photograph from 1922. These pipes had been dug up from the foundations of Shakespeare's house called New Place. And it occurred to me when I saw this photograph that I should write to the Shakespeare Trust in Stratford-on-Avon and ask for permission to look at these pipes, these clay tobacco pipes, long clay tobacco pipes as they
were. You've got some fragments here. They're about the size of the tip of your thumb and about that shape too. And these are all smashed up, no doubt because this wasn't an archaeological dig. It was enthusiastic gardeners and very light and presumably almost mass-produced.
They were mass-produced and smoked by people in higher society, like the knights of Queen Elizabeth I. But indeed I was given permission to look at these pipes from the foundations of New Place in Stratford-on-Avon. And it was just a thrill.
Did you have to go over?
I was already in London, So it was a short distance to go across to Stratford. It takes one about 2 hours west of London. And so I got to the little museum associated with the Shakespeare Trust, and I looked inside the pipe bowl, and I was thrilled because there was this black residue, black stuff, and thought, wow,
bingo.
I can now analyze this material to try to determine what kind of tobacco was smoked. So I then asked the curator, would you mind if I took these back to Pretoria, to South Africa, with a permit, of course.
So are these the two pipes that they let you bring back?
Oh, they allowed me to take temporarily 24 pipe fragments.
Wow, okay.
And I put them in bubble wrap and took them back to Pretoria. Now, what follows is really interesting. I took them to the narcotics laboratory of the South African police. And they had state-of-the-art technology to analyze dacha or whatever that was smoked illegally. They needed this information for court cases.
Evidence, yeah.
Well, I was a detective in a sense that I wanted to know what was smoked in Shakespeare's time. I couldn't tell that these pipes were smoked by the bard himself.
Yeah.
All I knew was that they'd come from his foundations, the foundations of his house. Anyway, what we did was we poured a little bit of chloroform into the pipe bowl, let it sit for 2 minutes, and then we'd pour the liquid out and put it into an instrument which was called a gas chromatography mass spectrometer. And yes, we found nicotine, which was not a surprise at all. Sir Walter Raleigh had brought the nicotine tobacco from North America. But what was really interesting were signals that were suggestive, highly suggestive, of dacha.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't be absolutely sure because the intensity of the signal was very, very low. So when I published the results together with my colleagues, including Inspector Tommy van der Merwe from the narcotics laboratory of the South African police.
Who was thrilled.
And also an archaeologist, a colleague of mine, Professor Nicholas from the University of Cape Town, Nick van der Merwe. So there were two van der Merwes in the team and one Thackeray. And we published our results respectfully in the South African Journal of Science. And we were very, very careful. We simply said there was suggestive evidence for the smoking of Dacha in the early 17th century. And we had included four pipes from Shakespeare's garden, as well as others from Stratford-on-Avon and the environment. Anyway, there was a great deal of interest in this.
I bet. That's a stone in the pond, if ever there was one. How far did the ripples reach?
Well, we were careful to say that the signal was just suggestive because of the intensity problem.
Mm. And the reputation of the man and the potential of what you were suggesting. Yes.
Well,
how did it go down?
The news spread like wildfire all over the world. There was a great deal of interest among the general public.
Mm.
And then I was interviewed by BBC World for the television. I was interviewed at the museum in Pretoria, where I was working at the time. This is 2001. And then BBC World Television also interviewed people in England who were the experts in the field of Shakespeare literary studies. And they were asked, what do you think of Dr. Thackeray's results? And one expert looked at the camera and said, these results are regrettable.
That's very contained, though. That's very English, isn't it? Regrettable.
Well, not to worry. I just presented an idea. It was a hypothesis to be tested. But we'd found not only nicotine tobacco, we'd found the suggestive evidence for cannabis. Then we found the third kind of tobacco.
That was the bombshell.
That was horror of horrors to some people, because we found cocaine.
Yeah, so regrettable was actually even more understated.
Mm-hmm. We had found, through the chemical analysis, evidence for the smoking of the coca plant, erythroxylin, from South America. And we had good reason to believe that it was brought to England by Sir Francis Drake, who had travelled around the world. He'd been to Peru, and he would so easily have been able to collect the kind of tobacco from Peru, which included the leaves of the coca plant. That's my view of things. And one then wonders, did Shakespeare smoke cocaine? And I deeply believe that the answer is no. There were only 2 out of 24 pipes which had evidence for the smoking of cocaine. Neither of them had come from Shakespeare's house. So I felt very strongly that Shakespeare wasn't involved. Furthermore, in Sonnet 76, he's writing about compound strange, and he doesn't want them. He's turning away from compound strange, but he wants the noted weed.
Okay, so he's had a go and decided it's not for him. But Dacha is reputed to enhance creativity, isn't it?
Oh, a professor from Harvard Medical School, Professor Lester Greenspoon, the late Lester Greenspoon, had declared that in moderation, cannabis had the potential for stimulating creativity. And I've referred to this in my various publications. So my interpretation is that Shakespeare preferred Dacha to stimulate creativity. And it is remarkable how fluid his writing is.
Okay, you're a scientist. You suspect things. Surely you want to go one further and prove to yourself and the world that Shakespeare did smoke at least the weed, if not the coke, and how to go about that.
What I'd really like to be able to do is to determine whether or not Shakespeare's teeth could tell us whether he smoked the pipe. And it was the custom when people smoked a pipe in Shakespeare's day was to chew on the pipe stem.
Mm.
And we know for a fact that this was a habit. People would hold clay pipes through their teeth.
But even to this day, I mean, my father smoked a pipe which is the size of an egg cup. And it was very much clenched between his teeth.
That's the word, clench. They would clench the pipe stem in their teeth between the canines and incisors.
And as the paleoanthropologist, yes.
And they typically developed a groove between those teeth. And so one way to determine whether or not William Shakespeare smoked a pipe was to look at their teeth. So I wrote to the Church of England and I asked whether or not I could exhume William Shakespeare.
Scandal.
And they said no. But that's understandable because on the tombstone of William Shakespeare are the words, "Cursed be he who moves my bones." So, of course, I expected from the Church of England that they would say, certainly not. Okay, but in my proposal, I said, I could understand that. What I really would like to do is to study his teeth. He didn't say anything about teeth in his epitaph. He wrote, "Cursed be he who moves my bones." Nothing about
it's
teeth.
It's splitting hairs, isn't it?
Well.
Anyway, yeah.
I wrote respectfully to the Church of England and wondered whether they might say yes, but sadly they said no. However, I have another plot. There is good reason to believe that Shakespeare was not necessarily buried under the tombstone, which says...
Where is he buried? Forgive my ignorance.
He is buried in Holy Trinity Church in Stratford-on-Avon.
Okay.
It's where he was baptised and where he was buried. Inside the church, not outside.
Because he was a celebrity at the time, was he?
Well, he was famous by 1616 when he died in his 50s, and it became known that he should be buried in the church.
Mm-hmm.
He was buried in the chancel, just inside the altar rail. And my view of things is that he should have been buried against the wall, first in the row. There are five members of his family buried in the same area, and he was the first to die in 1616. He was followed by Anne Hathaway, his good wife, who died in 1623. Then would follow Thomas Nash, and then John Hall, then Susanna Hall, all in a sequence.
They were cousins or something, were they?
They were relatives. Mm-hmm. Susanna was the daughter of William and Anne. Anyway, Shakespeare's...
Oh, did they have a daughter as well as a son?
They had Hamnet, the son, who died young. Susanna Hall was a daughter, and she married John Hall. But sadly, their offspring didn't survive. So we have no living direct descendants of William and Anne. Well, coming back to the order of the graves, Shakespeare's tombstone is second in the row. My hypothesis is that William was actually indeed first in the row, but his tombstone is second. So the tombstones got muddled up. That's my view.
Why would they get muddled up?
Well, they wouldn't have been intact initially. They simply would have been resting on the soil. Right. And these tombstones move.
And their renovations and things like that.
That's
there.
Right.
Mm.
Anyway, today we have the tombstone second in a row with his epitaph. "Cursed be he who moves my bones." And allegedly nobody has dug him up. There was a legend that in the 1700s, somebody did enter by night and stole the skull in the second position of the tombstones, believing it to be William Shakespeare's skull. That's a legend. That's only a legend. When I proposed to the Church of England that I should do some forensic analysis of the teeth to determine whether or not he smoked a pipe or to do chemical analysis on the teeth, now they said, unfortunately, no. And it was all very respectful. permission was given to a gentleman named Kevin Coles, and he was given permission to do non-destructive ground-penetrating radar. He used an instrument a little bit like a lawnmower, and he would move this lawnmower-like instrument over the graves, and it would send vibrations down into the ground, and that would be reflected up into the instruments of this lawnmower-type machine. And he was able to determine whether or not there were skeletons beneath the tombstones. And sure enough, there they were, a skeleton for every tombstone.
But not a headless one in one case.
Aha! In the case of the second tombstone, beneath that tombstone, there'd been disturbance.
Uh-oh.
And allegedly, the evidence pointed to the fact that that skull was missing. So they then began to take the legend seriously. My view is this, that somebody had taken a skull out of the grave 200 years ago, but it was Anne Hathaway's skull, second in the sequence. You understand?
Yes, because William was under the wrong tombstone.
He was probably the first in the row, and Anne Hathaway was second. And somebody had gone to the tombstone associated with "Cursed be he who moves my bones," and they took away that skull. And it was put in St. Leonard's Church in a crypt at Bearley in Worcestershire. And there it's been for 200 years. And then a forensic scientist decided to do a study to reconstruct the face of this person who was believed to be William Shakespeare. And guess what? She discovered that this skull represented a female.
Wow.
Now, you have to understand that Anne Hathaway died when she was about 70. And this skull put into the crypt at St. Leonard's at Bearley in Worcestershire was a 70-year-old woman. So, theoretically, I could write to the Church of England again and say, please, may I excavate the skeleton under the first tombstone associated allegedly with Anne Hathaway? Theoretically, they could say yes. There's no curse associated with her tombstone.
What does her tombstone say?
It said, amoveat lapidum. Amoveat lapidum means please move the tombstone.
No way.
Absolutely. It had been, well.
Why would that be written?
It was written by Susanna Hall, her daughter, and basically it was referring to the spirit of Anne, that she should be allowed to get out of the tomb and into the freedom. So, but it was an appeal. Move, please move this tombstone. So theoretically, I could ask the Church of England, please may I have permission to study this skeleton? And theoretically they would say yes.
So that investigation took place in 2001, as you heard mentioned. Why then are we covering the story now? Well, not only because a good story doesn't age, but because there have been some developments in Francis Thackeray's quest to get to the bottom of who the owner is, so to speak, of the Bearley skull. And he's going to tell us about those developments when next he graces Storycatcher with his presence. That'll be in a couple of weeks' time, and I hope you'll join us then. Bye-bye.